Okay, we're going to do a brief Q&A with Stan. It's going to be the same format. Raise your hand. We'll pick on you. You come up to the mic here. Again, we appreciate it if it doesn't turn into a speech. We can keep things moving. And
I'm not being critical, but next time we do one of these things, we need to get some Revolutionary Sisters up here, too.
I wanted to ask whether you have been doing a counter-recruitment? Yeah, recruitment.
Yep.
Thank you.
Did everybody hear that? Okay, it was. If I don't paraphrase you correctly, forgive me. I'm so toast right now. It was a question about how to go. If I'd done any kind of recruitment, and what are the right ways to sort of approach that task? I'm on the coordinating committee of the Bring Them Home Now campaign, and. This is an initiative that we're just in the formative process of right now, because it's just at this point where it's really become clear that this is such a tough problem inside the military. We're having a hard time getting accurate information from the Department of Defense, and I know that's a big surprise. When we read the story about the reporters going up and asking the troops in Iraq about the $10,000 bonus and they laughed at them, that was a pretty good battlefield indicator of what the attitude was. And then it's talking, we're actually in communication with some of the GIs that are over there. But this is something that's just, like I say, it's in the very first formative stages. It's not something that requires a lot of process. You know, that's the beauty of it. It's decentralized. It gives, you know, people from the hood can go down. You see what I'm saying? It's the people that you know. It's in your own neighborhoods where these recruitment offices are. And you can go, I think the GI Rights Hotline right now and the National Lawyers Guild Military Law Task Force both have information about to take with you for counter-recruitment, so just go find the right information. We will have some information on our website, but it's probably going to take a month or so before we get it up there. Check in on our website. We have news updates every day. We have a sound-off section in there where GIs can write in anonymously, veterans are writing in, military families are writing in and sounding off, and there's also some suggestions in there for getting involved in the community. But no, the short answer to your question is we haven't really kicked off in the counter-recruitment, but we see it as a high strategic priority. And again, don't overthink it. Just make sure you get the correct information and show up and talk to these kids, you know, because they're down there a lot of times. You know, they've been watching an Army of One, you know, and all this other just, you know, forgive me, but utter bullshit that they get from the media. And they hear about, you know, we're going to get money for college, you know, which you do. You get money for college, which is great, provided, you know, that you're not in a psych ward or an amputee ward or something like that whenever you have to go. So, you know, they just need a reality check when they go down there. And sometimes that'll make the difference. Yeah.
Thank you. Who's next?
Oh, he asked me why did I join the Army, and how did I end up here? Boy, oh boy, I'm writing my third book, and I still hadn't figured that out yet. I don't know. It was a long time ago. It was 34 years ago when I joined. I was a boy, you know, and you'd be surprised, you know, how much we damage boys whenever we raise them. You know, with the G.I. Joes and Disney and all that stuff. So, you know, I was doing a boy thing, and I believed in what Bill Blum was talking about earlier. I believed that I had to go out and do something about this international communist conspiracy, because if we didn't stop them in Vietnam, they'd be in Hot Springs, Arkansas in short order. And it sounded exciting, and I think I wanted to impress a girl. It's one of those things that's sort of, it's an overdetermined decision. so I don't know why I went in. But once you get in, I got out. I took a short break in service. I ended up in Monticello, Arkansas, working in a sweatshop, and it was real easy for me to go back in because I didn't like the sweatshop, and at least I got to work outdoors when I was in the Army. A piecework sweatshop, which is the worst kind of sweatshop, sewing inseams. And then the Army proceeded to give me the best radical education in the world by sending me to 8 conflict areas and let me spend a lot of time in developing countries, doing total cultural immersion and spending time with people that didn't look like me or speak my language, and making me smarter than I was before I got there. And there's a lot more people like that. Got my Veterans for Peace t-shirt on underneath this. And if you look around, there's 2 or 3 other people that were walking around in it. This notion of the military as like robots is just such nonsense. You know, the military people think at least as critically as the average American does in this, you know, consumerized, atomized, alienated society. And in some cases, they think even more clearly. And they ask a lot of questions. And I don't think that they deserve any special moral censure. People that work in Walmart are every bit as much of this system as people who work in the military. If you just back up and, you know, these are economic choices. These are economic choices. You know, I wouldn't go back in the military, but I sure as hell not going to go to work for Walmart either, if I can help it. And I'm not sure if I got off topic there, but again, you know, there were things. Parenti's book, Inventing Reality, was one of those things that sort of broke up a logjam for me a little bit. It's like, oh, okay, well then I don't have to believe any of this stuff. But then if I don't believe any of this stuff, what do I believe? And I started looking at things more directly. And the other thing that in particular was helpful for me was. In the 80s, I don't know. I worked directly out of the U.S. Embassy in Guatemala in 1983. I was there for the last coup d'état when Rios Montt was thrown out by Mejia Victorious. In 1985, I was in El Salvador working out of the embassy when Inez Guadalupe Duarte was kidnapped, and also right there about a week after the attack at Zona Rosa. So. I got a peek at the system. It was sort of a privilege peek because most military people don't get to work in the embassy. Got to see the country team. Everybody should look at a U.S. embassy and how it's organized, and it's quite an education. You got a consular section that does passports and visas and all that stuff, you know, and facilitates travel to and from. And you've got a security section that does security clearances and runs the ambassador's bodyguard detail. And then you've got the MIL group, that's the military liaison with the host nation, and you've got the Econ group, which is the liaison with the country's national chamber of commerce. No kidding, chamber of commerce. No, that's standard. That's the way it works. You know, and then you've got the ambassador and his or her deputy. And you got the political section, which is a euphemism for the Central Intelligence Agency. And when you watch the country team meetings, the agenda is set by the econ section. It's set by the economic section. That's who sets the agenda at the meetings. And it's like, oh. I mean, you know, I'm slow. It's like, oh, okay, I get it. It's the money. You know, because I really didn't want to believe that that's what the deal was. I didn't want to believe that that's why, you know, people were coming into the embassy bragging about the fact that they'd murdered Mayan school teachers. You know? So that shifted me a little bit. and then my last deployment to Haiti was probably the straw that broke the camel's back. But, you know, you learn. And it's not just me. I'm not like, unique. It's out there. I just scribble a lot more than most people. Yeah. Yes, sir.
This gentleman right here.
My question concerns bringing the troops home now, part of the equation. Didn't want to let U.S. troops, at least at this point, that they were afraid of destabilization and
WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville.
Kind of paraphrasing.
Yeah, it was a question about this is a big open question, and you know what was formerly the Unified Anti-War Movement before the actual the March Offensive took place. Whether or not American troops, now that they're there, should stay there to ensure a degree of stability so that the place doesn't break down into utter chaos and civil war. My own feeling, well, first of all, there's sort of two different, this administration has no intention of pulling out. They politically, they're stuck there. So we're not going to get a decision from the Bush administration to withdraw from Iraq, partly because there's not enough domestic discontent right now, you know, and they've got all their backup things like Diabol voting systems and all this other stuff. But so that's not what's going to happen. The call to bring them home now is a demand, and I think it's a legitimate demand. I don't think, regardless of what, you know, one person's anecdotal experience was with, you know, people who may or may not have been telling them what they wanted to hear. I don't think that the vandal that comes in and tears up my home is the right one for me to contract with to build it back up or to guard it from the next set of vandals. But the U.S. military occupation is not going to go from malignant to benign. And right now, the U.S. military occupation is really the catalyst for most of the violence there. In talking with Nasser earlier today, it's a much more complex situation than a lot of people are prone to believe in Iraq right now. And the notion that this is going to be utter chaos, in a way, in my opinion, I think that's sort of a racist presumption. And even if there is, because look, the place did get torn up. You know, we took basically a modern nation over the last 13 years, destroyed it. You know, destroyed its infrastructure, and we didn't destroy it because of the bad things that the Ba'ath Party did. We destroyed it because of the accomplishments they had. You know. They were being punished for what they did right. They've had about 6,000 more years experience at civilization than we have, and I think that they can handle their own history quite well. Thank you very much. You know. And there may be violence in a post-occupation environment, but I don't think it's going to be the cataclysmic violence for a number of reasons that I won't belabor here. And for that matter, you know, that's part of history. This country right here settled one of its biggest social issues with what was at that time the bloodiest confrontation in human history. That's the way we settled the issue of slavery, you know, and replaced it with wages. But we settled that social question in a very bloody way, but it was our history. And I think the Iraqis are the only people who are going to be competent to participate in that way in their own history. And I don't think the United States needs the power to control fossil energy for the rest of the world. You know.
We're going to, in the interest of ending on time, we're going to take one last question. Gentleman right here in the glasses. Could you do me a favor and please come to the mic because nobody can hear it?
I just can't see.
Thank you anyway. We appreciate it.
They've got an interrogation light in my eyes over here.
Since you mentioned Haiti, I'm curious what's your take on the current destabilization going on there currently?
I'm glad you asked that question. Hey, Haiti is a perfect example of the way the United States meddles in other people's affairs and then turns around and blames everything that's wrong on them. Haiti is being destabilized. Well,
And this is a long story. I would recommend that everybody here, if you don't know what the National Endowment for Democracy is, go do a web search and find out what it is. The National Endowment for Democracy is a front organization that operates in conjunction with the United States Agency for International Development and the political section of the embassy in these other countries to manufacture election results. And if they can't manufacture election results, then they go out and they create these fake oppositions or these collaborative oppositions. UNO in Nicaragua is an example. The opposition in Yugoslavia that was used to destabilize them, and the so-called opposition is Convergence Démocratique. What a beautiful, it's a democratic convergence, which is 18 parties that together couldn't get 6% of the vote in Haiti, and this is supposed to be the legitimate opposition in Haiti. And what they're doing is that they want to demonize Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was elected with 94% of the vote, and cause his government to step down before the next election. Same way they're doing with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela right now. That's an NED operation from the get. This is what they do. And it's not to say that the people that they oppose are always necessarily, you know, great people. Aristide has made mistakes. But as a Haitian friend of mine said, the Haitian people have a right to be wrong. And you know, plus when someone gets beat by 500,000 votes in this country and takes office, they got a lot of damn nerve going someplace where they get 94% of the vote and tell them it's not a legitimate election, you know. But that's what's going on. The destabilization going on down right. And the mainstream press collaborates in this stuff. I mean, in such a craven way. They just lap it up. And this is, again, where they there's this repetition, the questionable elections. And you'll hear this questionable elections as a mantra. And I was there during the elections. I was there during the inauguration. There was nothing questionable at all. In fact, the Provisional Electoral Council had a majority of the opposition in it, and they were the ones that ran the election. But they didn't come up with the right result, and so they started setting up, you know, parallel governments and all this stuff because they don't like anybody. And the opposition to Aristide is not the opposition to Aristide. Aristide is a guy who has the power right now because of his emotional connection with the masses in Haiti to mobilize those masses. When they shot his brother-in-law, he said four words and instituted a nationwide rebellion. That's the power that scares them. When they attack Aristide, it's not Aristide's power that they're afraid of. What they're afraid of is the power of the Haitian masses. And that's exactly the case of what's going on with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela right now. They're not afraid of Hugo Chavez. They're afraid of these Bolivarian circles, which are community organizations, you know, who've gone out and taught people how to do things like read the Constitution, you know, so they can use it for themselves. So anyway, I've gone on long enough, and I'm not sure if I'm making any sense at this point, but thank you all so much.